The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
All right, welcome to a Wednesday, everyone. Now, if you are a normal person, you probably slept pretty well last night. If you are not normal, like me, you are up. Now, I was up, and the thing is, the television in the bedroom doesn't get C-SPAN. That's why we're thrilled that C-SPAN exists online. Because this morning, as I decided to, you know, go back through what happened last night in the Senate, I realized I got an alert on my phone a little bit after four, I believe, telling me that the Senate passed the budget resolution, which just means that now they can go ahead and write the reconciliation bill. It hasn't been written yet, but it allows them to proceed along those lines. All they needed was 50 votes. They got 50 votes. In fact, Kamala Harris presided over the Senate yesterday in case her tie-breaking vote was needed, as was expected, because it's a 50-50 split in the Senate. Actually, it's 48-50 with two independents. Thankfully, the two independents, Bernie Sanders and Angus King, both caucus with the Democrats, so it's as good as 50-50. Anyway, one Republican senator did not show up at work yesterday. It was Senator Rounds of South Dakota, and I went in search of trying to figure out why he wasn't there. What could possibly be so important that you skip, like, one of the most important votes in your career? And at first I read it was a personal family thing, and then I read he accompanied his wife for a cancer treatment. Guess what? That's a valid excuse. So I guess his Republican colleagues couldn't bitch too much. So, oh, shoot, I forgot to turn on YouTube. Oh, YouTube was, I'm so sorry. Thank you, Gary Ballard, for reminding me to turn you on. I'll always turn you guys on. God, I got to enable the automatic thing. There you are. Hi, YouTube. I'm so sorry. So just to recap for the YouTubers, all you missed was that I'm talking about last night in the Senate, how they had this, you know, the Votorama. Once they passed the so-called bipartisan infrastructure bill, and it passed with 19 Republican votes, so I guess it is bipartisan, they immediately moved on to the budget resolution, which is the basis for the other infrastructure bill, the $3.5 trillion bill that's going to go that's going to, you know, be passed through reconciliation because it's a budgetary concern and they're not going to be able to get 10 Republicans to vote for it. So after they passed it yesterday, they immediately launched into that. And then as I'm getting ready, you know, I wake up early in the morning and I put together the What's News newscast that runs throughout the day on the Progressive Voices channel. It's available as a podcast. In fact, if you subscribe to the podcast of the show, you also get What's News every day, and it's posted, you know, it's all free, so go find it. Anyway, so I'm trying to piece together what happened last night. So let me give you the basics of what happened. I should just read this whole thing. So it was early yesterday morning, around 11:30, I guess early morning for some people. The Senate Democrats... I'm backing up. On Tuesday, 11-ish, they voted to pass. I'm sorry, I'm all over the place, aren't I? Deep breath, Nicole. Start over. All right, so Tuesday, they voted to advance that bipartisan infrastructure bill. The final vote, 69-30, included 19 Republicans. And then the next step is it goes to the House. But it's not going anywhere yet because Nancy Pelosi even said we are not going to take up that bill until we have the other part, the other infrastructure bill. That's the reconciliation bill, right? So they went into their Votorama before they could actually get to the vote on the, you know, the budget resolution. So, yeah, it's complicated. And isn't obviously, as I'm trying to explain it to you, I'm kind of fumfering, right? I see Jan Morgan says, I'm so confused. Well, here's what happens. They only needed 50 votes to pass the resolution because it's a budget thing. It's going to pass through reconciliation. But before they could take that vote, they had to get through the Votorama. That's when anybody and everybody can offer up amendments. And it went for 15 hours. 15 hours. And the Votorama is kind of a relic because the amendments are non-binding. By the way, so is the budget resolution. But that's besides the point. The thing that the Votorama does do is it provides a look at where each side stands. For example, there was one amendment calling for a ban on fracking, right? Eight of the Democrats voted along with all the Republicans. So those are the two, you know, the two Democrats from Colorado, Michael Bennett and John Frackenlooper, appropriate name, Bob Casey of Pennsylvania, both senators from New Mexico, Martin Heinrich and Ben Ray Lujan, of course, Joe Manchin and John Tester, all voted against the amendment calling for a ban on fracking. Lovely. Another amendment that would have prevented federal funding for fossil fuel burning power plants had Mark Kelly and Kyrsten Sinema join in along with Manchin and Tester to vote with the Republicans. Kelly, Sinema, and Manchin also voted with the Republicans to means test tax credits for electric vehicles. So there were a lot of those head-scratcher type votes. Like Joe Manchin being the only Democrat to join every Republican in supporting Tom Cotton's amendment prohibiting the teaching of critical race theory in K through 12 schools. Really, Joe? No K through 12 school teaches critical race theory. But I digress. So the Votorama went on for 15 hours, and it was right around 4 a.m. this morning that the budget resolution passed along party lines, 50 to 49 Senator Rounds of San Diego missing for the whole day. And then it also goes to the House for approval. But you see, the resolution needs to be approved by both chambers before the Democrats can move on to the reconciliation plan. God, even it's just so much going on. So anyway, this brings us to like 4 a.m. yesterday morning. Now, the House is on recess, and their recess is scheduled to last until September 20th. So they wouldn't take up any of this until near the end of September, more than a month away. Their recess is 7 weeks long. Well, Majority Leader Steny Hoyer sent a letter to his caucus last night, or to, well, I guess, the whole chamber, saying that they will come back to work the week of August 23rd to consider the budget resolution. And that's a good thing. And that's all they'll consider. They won't consider the first, the bipartisan infrastructure plan until the reconciliation plan is written and passed, because that's what Nancy Pelosi said, right? But so, but back to last night, because they weren't done with the business yet. What we heard was that Chuck Schumer planned to, once they got through the budget resolution, to immediately move on to voting rights. The thing is, this was about 4 o'clock in the morning. All right. So we were all sleeping or in bed or otherwise occupied. So what I thought I would do is go to the videotape and share with you some of what transpired between, you know, 4 and 6 a.m. last night, or actually this morning. All right. So you ready? So here, let me bring up I need to bring up the right computer. And you'll see Tim Kaine, Senator Tim Kaine, was presiding. He was the presiding officer at the Senate. Chuck Schumer had just said, okay, resolution passed. And now, well, let me play for you what he said. Take it away, Chucky Schmucky.
And now, Mr. President, I ask unanimous consent the Senate proceed to immediate consideration of S-2093 for the People Act of 2021.
Yeah.
Is there objection?
It sounds
seeing
like
none, so ordered. Oh, Senator from Texas.
Of course. Ted Cruz.
Reserving the right to object. This bill would constitute a federal government takeover of elections.
What? Yeah.
It would constitute a massive power grab by Democrats.
It would?
It would disenfranchise millions of Americans.
Really?
And it would do precisely the opposite of its nominal title, For the People. It is instead For the Politicians.
No, but
because
okay.
It entrenches politicians and ensures that the people cannot vote out of office.
Well, it ensures that you couldn't steal it.
Every reasonable voter integrity law in the country, including voter ID laws supported by the overwhelming majority of this country, including prohibitions on ballot harvesting.
Okay.
Again,
all right.
Widely
we heard
supported
you, Ted.
By people in this country. It would
mandate and you'll see that Chuck, I can't listen to him. Chuck Schumer was prepared for this objection because you'll see when he speaks again, he's reading. It's scripted. All right. You done yet, Cruz?
Reason, I object.
Okay.
The objection is heard.
Mr. President.
Majority Leader.
The Republican minority has just prevented the Senate from even having a debate. A debate.
Yes.
Just that.
Just that.
On voting rights in this country.
You see him reading. There's
I
no surprise here.
My Republican colleagues don't approve of every aspect of the Democratic bill to protect voting rights.
Right.
But surely there are areas where our two parties can find some agreement. Partisan gerrymandering, for instance.
Yes. Partisan gerrymandering.
Our country for too long. It skews our democracy towards the extremes. It strips the American people of their right to have a truly representative government.
Yes, it does.
Voters ought to pick their politicians, not the other way around.
True.
But in so many states, partisan legislators draw maps that artificially maximize the number of seats that the majority party will win.
Okay.
Some districts are so safe that the most extreme candidates can run.
So what Chuck Schumer is doing here is Ted Cruz stopped any action on the For the People Act because he objected. So Schumer now is moving on to the Redistricting Reform Act.
But one that has broad universal support. So I ask unanimous consent and the support, by the way, of all 50 of my colleagues, of 49 of my Democratic colleagues. So I ask unanimous consent that the Senate proceed to the immediate consideration of S-2670, Calendar 119,
the Redistricting Reform Act
of 2021.
Is there objection?
Mr. President.
Senator from Texas.
Ted Cruz
reserving
again.
Reserving the right to object.
Oh, my God.
The text
you
of
know
the
what? So the Redistricting Reform Act, S-2670, limits partisan gerrymandering. And, of course, here's Raphael Cruz objecting to this one as well.
That redistricting is controlled by the people.
Bullshit.
We have an unfortunate pattern
in today's
Congress.
Oh, he's such a liar.
Which is today's Democrats no longer believe in democracy.
Bullshit.
Their Bill S-1,
what
many call the Corrupt Politicians
Act.
Oh,
bullshit. Okay.
Is designed
all right. I can't. So let's move ahead a little further. So Teddy Cruz.
The bill to remove the state legislatures from their constitutionally appointed responsibility of being in charge of redistricting.
Partisan gerrymandering is what it does. It outlaws partisan gerrymandering. And he's objecting.
Now, redistricting and gerrymandering can lead to ugly consequences.
You think?
This is not new. The founders were well aware of
God. Could he be more condescending? No, you're
indeed,
an ugly consequence of gerrymandering.
Comes from Eldridge Gerry.
Okay, shut up. All right. So let's move ahead to the next. Okay. Oh, next up, I think Sheldon Whitehouse has something to say.
Be considered made and laid upon the table.
Mr. President.
Majority Leader.
I object.
Thank you.
To the senator from Texas legislation.
I do, too.
It's obvious to just about every American. It would make a bad situation even worse.
Yes.
So I object.
I object, too.
Is there objection to the original request from the senator of New York?
I object.
Ugh.
Objection is...
Mr. President,
God.
In conclusion, before I turn it over to some of my colleagues.
Oh, my God.
So Democrats have tried to do something very simple. We asked the Senate to start debate on legislation to protect voting rights and strengthen our democracy.
Yep.
Republicans said no. Democrats asked to debate a measure just to prevent partisan gerrymandering.
That's right.
And I'm frankly, in my colleague's response, he was all over the lot. It's good to have politicians do it. It's not good to have politicians do it. It's good to have judges do
it.
It's not good to have judges do it. We would set standards to make sure that in a state like Wisconsin, where 53% of the people voted for a Democratic member of the state assembly,
yeah,
only a third of the districts were Democratic, drawn by a Republican legislature.
Of course.
So Republicans have said no, they don't even want to debate these issues.
Nope.
Democrats asked to debate a measure to bring much-needed transparency to campaign donations and get special interest dark money.
Okay, and that is the Disclose Act, and I must have skipped over that. But he tried to bring up the Disclose Act, which requires additional campaign finance disclosure. And once again, Cruz objected, then tried to bring up his own legislation that would eliminate contribution limits to campaigns. And that's what Chuck Schumer just objected to. I just couldn't listen to Ted Cruz ramble on anymore. I just couldn't go there. So now we're to the point where Chuck Schumer is about to finish, but what he's going to do right here now is say that the Senate will consider the compromise voting rights bill when they return from recess in September. That's where he's going now.
Politics. Republicans still said no. So let there be no mistake about what is going on here. We have reached a point in this chamber where Republicans appear to oppose any measure, no matter how common sense, to protect voting rights and strengthen our democracy.
You think?
Let there be no mistake, both inside this chamber and outside of it. Republicans have formed a wall, a total wall, of opposition against progress on voting rights in the United States Senate. Even on an issue as sacred as the right to vote, Senate Republicans refuse to allow even a debate. They're afraid to debate it.
That's right.
Yesterday morning, we saw what it looks like when the Senate comes together.
Which they did.
This is what it looks like when it doesn't.
Uh-huh.
Apparently, there are very serious and important limits to bipartisanship. There are some issues where Republicans refuse to join us in good faith to make progress for our country.
So it went on. It went on like that. I'm not going to keep boring you because Chuck Schumer can certainly go on. But what happened was then they had some other business to take care of, some nominations, right? Some judicial and other nominations. Ted Cruz objected to everything going forward. That man needs to be voted out of office. Beto O'Rourke, you should have taken him on last time. Take him on next time. Ted Cruz has got to go. Send him into exile along with Donald Trump, please. I think it's time to get to our guest, don't you? Let's bring him on. Okay. You there, Will Bunch?
Blackburn.
Oops, wrong one. Hello? I think he's here. Oh, I guess I need to do this. It's been a while since we've spoken. But Will Bunch joins us today from the Philadelphia Inquirer, where he's a national journalist. I get such a kick when I see your byline in the Miami Herald. It doesn't happen all that often, but every now and then there you are. And it gives me the chance to read you in our local paper down here.
Yeah, it's a dream. It's great. It's great to be in a syndication loop like that. And, Every once in a while, all of a sudden, out of the blue, I'll start getting a bunch of angry emails from Minnesota, and I know it was in the Minneapolis Star Tribune or something like that. But you know, the Miami Herald is just a great paper. I actually worked very closely, and I'm a good friend with their star reporter, Julie K. Brown, former Philadelphia superstar. So.
In fact, she was on the show just last week for her new book, Perversion of Justice, because she's the one who broke the story, really, about Jeffrey Epstein.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's just great seeing her get the recognition she deserves. I'm still slightly bitter that she didn't get a Pulitzer that year for reasons that totally baffle me. But she's gotten everything else. She's gotten the book deal and she's gotten the movie deal. And
yeah.
I don't know. Did you ask who's going to play her in the movie? I haven't.
I didn't. I just went so far as to ask if it had been optioned. Yes.
Yeah.
And she said, yeah, absolutely. So there will be a movie and she will play a role in it. It's often, you know, the writers of the book are not in the story, but she was so instrumental in this. This was a case that had already been litigated, not not in a positive way, I think. I mean, Epstein got off very easily. She went back and really looked into it. And it's, if not for her, we wouldn't even know the story, right?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. So, I mean, this is one of those cases where the reporter is a huge part of the story, yeah. Because it was a cold case, basically. You know, I mean, that's what makes it so amazing. I mean, like you said, I mean, this has been sort of litigated. He'd gotten basically a slap on the wrist, you know, this kind of cushy house arrest deal. And she went back and reopened it. I mean, the weird thing is, as I understand it, I think we can actually quote, thank, unquote, Donald Trump in a way, because I think his naming Alex Acosta, labor secretary, was what was the spark that rekindled some of the interest in that, which is very interesting.
Probably.
Minding Herald's a great paper.
Yeah. Well, it's not as great as it used to be, because now it's owned by a venture capital group. I mean, it's all, you know, it's all hedge funds that are buying up newspapers now. And I asked Julie about the Miami Herald, and, you know, she wasn't very optimistic about the future because of the way it's become, but she was happy when I said, we subscribe, at least we get the Herald delivered, and used it as a way to encourage people to please support your local newspapers, because if we lose them, we're really screwed.
Yeah, I mean, that's wonderful to do that, because I do the same thing myself, because, you know, it's, I mean, so many people listening to this probably subscribe to their local public radio station. Mm-hmm. And it's weird with newspapers, because news organizations like your newspaper basically aren't nonprofits, right? Like NPR is, although mine, the Philadelphia Inquirer, actually is owned by a nonprofit, which is unusual. But yeah, so you know, we need to get into the mindset of, yes, it's a business, but really it's also a civic institution, and it needs, it plays a role that helps the public, and the public are the ones who can basically support this and keep it going. So,
right. You know, the problem is that everybody, you know, charging here and there, it's hard to keep up. And, you know, for instance, my show is not behind a paywall because I operate on the old public radio model, which is, it's free for everyone to listen. There was no way to put a paywall on a radio that you could just turn on and off in your car or on your home stereo or a clock or whatever. But I do survive on listener donations. So I hope those who enjoy the program and can afford a couple extra bucks a month kick it in. But I don't have a paywall. So that's why, you know, I went to read your column today, and I was disappointed because there's a paywall on everything now.
Well, let me say, if I can just do, I don't want to take up too much time on this, but I do want to do a quick plug in the sense of the column today was paywalled because it's this column that comes out every Tuesday is also my weekly newsletter.
Uh-huh. Oh,
the weekly newsletter is free.
Yes.
Anybody who wants to read the weekly newsletter can sign up for free. And when you do that, it takes 5 seconds.
Yep.
All you have to do is go to this website and type in your email address. That's literally all you have to do. And you don't have to pay a dime. It's free. And
gotcha.
You get it every Tuesday. And we decided, when I say we, they decided, I didn't decide, but they right. decided as part of the strategy that the Tuesday newsletter thing, which had been also running online for free, is only there's still going to be an online version, but it's only for subscribers.
I see.
So, and it's hard because, you know, it's, I'm in a very weird situation. I mean, 90 to 95% of what we do is very locally oriented. Mm-hmm. I happen to be the national columnist, so
yes.
I'm in the other 5%. So I write about national issues. So I have people who want to read me who live in Seattle or Florida, you know,
yes,
I totally understand why they wouldn't want to subscribe to the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Although right now, I got to tell you, because I went there today and I didn't realize it was the same as the newsletter, because I get your newsletter. Knowing that I was talking to you today and I couldn't read the whole thing, I said, you have a special now, 99 cents for 8 weeks. So I signed up for it. I can afford a buck for 8 weeks.
See,
that.
See, the plan is working. the scheme.
There you go. But I also made a note in my little book here, my scheduling book, on December 5th or whatever the date is that I have to cancel it, because then it comes out to like $5 a week after that. And frankly, that's too rich for my blood these days, just because there's so many different outlets between the newspapers we want to read online and then all the streaming services. You know, if you cut the cord, you wind up paying more because you subscribe to all the different services out there. So,
you know, and people keep asking, why don't you have a Netflix? Why don't you have a Netflix for news? You know, where you can just pay, you know, $12.99 a month and get all those late newspapers. And I wish apparently that's complicated. I guess that's not my, that's above my pay grade.
Yeah, so mine as well.
I don't know how that stuff works.
So let's get to it. So Will Bunch, you in reading today's column and today's newsletter, which everyone should subscribe to, by the way, I learned that this week was an auspicious anniversary. In fact, I pulled the front page of the Philadelphia Inquirer from what was the date? Was it 1974 or before?
August 9th, 1974. And it's funny because above the desk, above my desk in the newsroom where I have not sat for the last 16 months is a framed version of that exact newspaper.
Oh, how funny. This is what I meant to show. So yeah, there's at least the top fold of the front page of the Philadelphia Inquirer from that day. I remember clearly where I was when Nixon resigned. I was 14 years old. I was on a teen tour of the U.S. for the summer. We were in a bus driving, I don't know, somewhere like Salt Lake, between Salt Lake City and California, when the tour leader, the counselor, basically told us, and the whole bus full of 14-year-olds started cheering. That's my memory of Nixon resigning. And you know, here we are this week. We had Andrew Cuomo resign, which needed to happen, but I feel compelled to mention constantly what a great man Mario Cuomo was. And I had the distinct opportunity and honor of working with him when I was just a mere youngin' out of college. I was working in New York at WMCA. I was a producer, and Mario Cuomo was the governor, and he would come down once.
We did a monthly
Ask the Governor statewide call-in show that I produced every month, and he was the best. He was so great. I just adore him.
Yeah, no, it's funny, Nicole, because I knew Mario Cuomo as well.
Wow.
In the late 80s, I was a reporter for Newsday on Long Island. And we had a weird system, which we would kind of flood Albany with reporters when the legislature was in session. So we'd have one person who was up there full time, and then but when the legislature met, we'd rotate two or three people up there, and they'd put us up in an apartment for like two or three months, three or four months at a time. And I love Albany. It was great. I had a great time up there. Well, it's a bunch of transient people who have nothing to do, but you know, go out to the few fancy restaurants in Albany and then go out to the bars every night. So, and I was young and it was fun.
Well, because I tell the story, you know, Mario Cuomo was really good to me. I've got a lovely letter of recommendation from him. I've got autographed pictures. He wrote a thing to my dad, but he offered me a job in his press office, but it would have entailed me moving to Albany. And I was,
you didn't want to go to Albany. We would have had a good time in the bars.
I guess.
I dealt with him. It was funny. The very first time I was part of the little pack that was sent into his office in Albany for a news conference, I asked him a question. It was the very first time I asked him a question. And whatever it was I asked, he didn't like it. So he kind of snapped at me a little bit. Because he did have a bit of a temper in certain situations, right? Kind of like his son, but not nearly as malevolent. Well, not as malevolent, I don't think. And but what was different than Andrew Cuomo was about a half hour later, I was in our little office inside the state capitol, and the phone rang, and it was Mario Cuomo with his press secretary. And he just wanted to apologize for snapping it.
Wow. That's the Mario Cuomo that I remember. He was so, you know, there was nothing creepy about him, but he would come in and I'd see him once a month and he'd say, "You cut your hair." It looks great. Or you lost a couple of pounds. I mean, he would always notice something. And I never got the feeling like he was bullshitting me. It just felt genuine. He felt like genuinely good person. And that's
very kind of an old world kind of person. What's the word I'm looking for? Just kind of, polite and a person of manners, I think I would call him. And I don't know. Maybe I'm trying to figure out something maybe to write about the Cuomo family. And I don't know, maybe something on the evils of our ruined meritocracy, because, we have so many of these family dynasties in politics. And I mean, they're a mixed bag. Sometimes the children end up being wonderful public servants, but a lot of times we get the name and we don't get the same person.
That's right. Well, and now, of course, now the Foxies, the right wing nut jobs, are talking about there's a bridge in New York that was named for Mario Cuomo. And now they're saying, well, should we take his name away because it's right. also Andrew Cuomo's name? No, it's named for Mario Cuomo. So leave it alone.
Yeah, absolutely. And he there were many things about, in addition to his personality, I think there were a lot of great things about his governorship, particularly even though it wasn't the most critical issue in terms of affecting people. But the fact that he held the line against the death penalty in the 80s and the early 90s, when every other Democrat kind of knuckled under to this whole law and order routine. And he had an ethical problem with the death penalty, and he would not bend to the polls, to mm-hmm. political pressure. And I just admired that greatly.
Yeah, I admired him greatly. And that's why this is so disturbing. Anyway, that's something that happened this week. And it's interesting that it was in the same week of the year that Nixon resigned all those years ago. But you mention it in your column. And you're right. Sunday marked the 47th anniversary of Nixon resigning the presidency in disgrace amid the Watergate scandal. After Gerald Ford pardoned him a few days later, Nixon told David Frost this.
Well, when the president does it, that means that it is not illegal.
That's one of the classic, sound bites of all time. When the president does it, that means it is not illegal. And that seems to be the theory that Donald Trump operated under. You did write in this column of the other things we learned over the last week or so about the final days of the Trump presidency, when he was trying anything and everything to hold on to it. And we learned about Jeffrey Clark, who I found out from your column is from Philadelphia. Yeah. There's always something there, right?
Always a Philadelphia connection. It's amazing.
Jeffrey Clark, shouldn't he be, I would think participating in a coup, it should be illegal. Isn't that an arrestable offense?
I mean, clearly crimes were committed here. There's just no question. If you're using your clout as a high-ranking public official, whether it's as a top person in the Justice Department, or whether it's in the case of Donald Trump as President of the United States, if you're using your ability to wield political influence, and you're telling people to change election results or lie about fraud in an election, and say that fraud occurred when fraud did not occur, that's election tampering.
Yes.
That's using your political office to try and tamper with the results of a free and fair election. So, that's a crime. And I know Trump is being investigated in the state of Georgia, right, in Fulton County, for exactly mm-hmm. that, because for whatever reason, he was very fixated on Georgia in particular. And we've known since the spring that he made those phone calls to the Georgia Secretary of State.
We've heard the phone calls.
So we know that happened. I mean, we don't know exactly what the status of the federal, the U.S. Justice Department investigation, or if there is a U.S. Justice Department investigation into that aspect of it. Really, it's a little bit unclear. And the related conspiracy here is January 6th itself, the incitement to violence.
Yes.
Which was basically part of the same conspiracy, which was that you know, he was going to try and pressure Congress not to certify Biden's election in two ways. One was, you know, using the power of the Justice Department and other offices he controlled as president to, you know, try and convince Congress not to certify. And if that didn't work, he was going to send an armed mob to the Capitol to pressure them and to obstruct the proceedings, possibly, which they did. They, right. You know, they obstructed the proceedings for 10 hours or however long it was, 8 or 10 hours. So this is a conspiracy, you know, and the thing is, I mean, why do we charge people with any crime? You know, it's a deterrent, not only, you know, it's a deterrent to anybody else who would dare think about doing this in the future.
Right.
And, you know, we don't know if Trump is going to run again. I mean, if it were 2024 now, he definitely would be running, you know. We'll see how his health and everything else does in the next couple of years, or if he is charged by one of these entities that's investigating him. But even if it's not Trump, even if it's Ron DeSantis, your governor, or if it's, you know, if it's somebody else, you know, we need some deterrent to make sure that this isn't tried again. I mean,
we do. You know, Will Budge, you have a line that I pulled out. You wrote, "Not charging Trump and his associates with the conspiracy to tamper with the election and incite violence on January 6th would essentially amend the Constitution to ratify that when a president does it, that means it is not illegal. Democracy will wither if we allow a hitman to roam free." So absolutely 100% true. And yet, where's the fierce urgency of now? Why has nobody been charged with this? This is treason. This is insurrection. This is that we came so close, as we learned this past week, to a successful coup upending a free and fair election. And it's like molasses rolling down the street. I'm blown away by the lack of urgency and by the lack of action.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think some of that comes from the top. I mean, I think President Biden, who I think, you know, you've seen some of the really good things about the Biden presidency happen this week.
Yeah,
you know,
on
infrastructure, on, you know, the forward progress of this budget thing, which would just be kind of an FDR level game changer for this country.
Yeah.
And but he also feels, you know, and let's not forget, he was part of the Obama administration.
Yep.
And, you know, I feel like I've told this anecdote on your show once before, so maybe stop me. But, you know, talking about the politicians we've known and questioned over the years, I had one chance to meet and ask a question of Barack Obama when he was a candidate in 2008. And I asked him if he was going to do anything, or, you know, if he would appoint somebody to the Justice Department who would do something about torture, you know, Gitmo and all the other various crimes that were committed during the Bush-Cheney administration. And, you know, he was still running in a Democratic primary. So he gave me kind of a mushy answer where he wasn't ruling it out and maybe, and, you know, terrible things happened and we should look into it. And, you know, but I mean, as soon as he won the election, his line immediately became,
"We're going
to
look forward
and not look back."
And
that was, you know, and we've heard this excuse, you know, again and again, you know, that, you know, Ronald Reagan was too old and feeble and his term was almost over and the nation had just gone through the trauma of Watergate and we can't do that again. So we can't, take a Iran-Contra, which was a horrific abuse of the Constitution. I mean, just straight up ignoring a law that was passed by Congress. You know, we couldn't look at that. We couldn't take seriously torture and other crimes that were committed during the Bush years.
Right.
And, you know, now we have a guy in Trump who's gone just over the top in terms of basically, you know, committing a criminal conspiracy to try and thwart the peaceful transfer of power, which, you know, every time you hear people talk about this American exceptionalism that supposedly exists, the thing they always say is, look, we have 200, you know, with, you know, we have 244 or however long since the Constitution, 232 years of uninterrupted peaceful transfers of power
until Donald Trump.
Yeah. Of course,
right? That
you have to have an asterisk, you have to have an asterisk for the Civil War because 1860 wasn't a particularly peaceful transfer of power either. But five people were killed on Capitol, or five people died on Capitol Hill. That wasn't a very peaceful transfer.
And you know what? When you think about it, remember in the weeks leading up to the election, Donald Trump was asked numerous times by a number of different journalists, will you accept the results of the election and participate in a peaceful transfer of power? And he wouldn't answer it because he knew then, look, the whole stop the steal nonsense was already ready to go in 2016 because he expected to lose, but they were going to pull it out then. He was going to say it was rigged. And in fact, he did all constantly during that election talk about the rigged election. But when he won, you never heard that peep again until 2020, and he loses, and then they pull out the playbook from 4 years ago. It just blows my mind that the American people are so gullible. How do they get taken by a con?
They're very good. They're very good at like kind of whataboutism or whatever you want to call it. You know, I mean, in 2016, it's like they set it up basically. Like in 2016, if you remember, there was this whole question of Trump refused to say that if he won the election in 2016, that he might prosecute Hillary Clinton.
Right.
Over the emails, right? Or whatever. So,
right. Benghazi. Don't forget Benghazi.
And so people were outraged when he said that because they said, well, this is America. The winner of the election doesn't criminally prosecute the loser of the election. But the reason people said that was because Hillary Clinton clearly hadn't committed any crime, you know? You know, as far as the emails, you know, and I mean, her conduct wasn't perfect, but it was looked at by the FBI and you know, which was not a particularly friendly FBI.
Her conduct was not an inch of what the people in the Trump administration did. So,
but now they do the whataboutism. It's like, you said it would be the worst thing for the winner to prosecute the loser of the election, and now you're doing exactly that. Well, that's because, in this case, the loser of the election actually committed a crime, and they use this whataboutism to try and thwart it. I hate to say it, but it works to a sense because you have I think Biden and I think Merrick Garland, who
is horrible. You know, I'm sorry, terrible, horrible.
I mean, he's an admirable person in some ways, and he's done a few good things as Attorney General, but he's just not the right man for the job at this time because we need people, I mean, America's house is on fire in three different places right now. Right.
Yep. Yep.
From the virus, from climate change, mm-hmm. and from, threat to our democracy, you know, this
yes.
threat to
our democracy, yeah. our vote, yeah. it's still in peril right. and it's still Trump calling the shots on that.
Right. And we need people to act with house on fire urgency.
Yes, I mean,
Merrick Garland is not that guy, you know, and Biden temperamentally is not that guy. I mean, obviously, he says again and again, and I believe it, that he ran for president because of what he saw in Charlottesville in 2017. And I mean, he does.
He's been running for president since the 80s. He wanted to be president. You know, Joe Biden always wanted to be president.
And he's a good politician, and he adapts. But yeah. he does, which is true, and he does adapt. But that can be good in a way. I mean, he's adapted, I think, in positive ways to the situation we're in. So, somebody in that Justice Department or somewhere has got to flip on the switch and say, you know,
Let's move, and
I mentioned this in my column. I mean, hypothetically, if Donald Trump were indicted by the Justice Department and he was arraigned and booked or, you know, put in handcuffs, or I wouldn't do that, right? But whatever, if all those things happened, it would be ugly. There would be right-wing people out in the streets.
But they're out in the streets anyway.
Yeah, as I pointed out. Yeah, exactly. Yep. But, you know, they're already acting out anyway. But, you know, I mean, people would be screaming bloody murder and you know, this is America. We don't, you know, but that's the thing. I mean, what is America? Is America a country that is never going to prosecute somebody who was the president, no matter what they did? Or is America a country that's ruled by law? You know,
and we're at that point. We're at the fork in the road. Which way are we going to go? So a couple other things that I do want to touch on while I've got you here, because you brought them up in this week's column, in this week's newsletter. The IPCC report that was released earlier this week, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, was devastating, but they said things that people needed to hear. They said that without a doubt, this climate change is the byproduct of man and our actions. They said it's dire, it's moving faster than we had imagined. But as you point out, they say it is not beyond the point of no return yet. We can still act. There's still time to turn things around. But did you see some of the Voterama last night? Joe Manchin's voting with the Republicans to, keep tax breaks for fossil fuel power plants. And you know, it's just the same old that I think too many members of Congress, not only here, but people in power around the world, just aren't understanding the memo.
Yeah, I mean, we have this horrible dynamic around fossil fuels in Congress, in that if you're one of the 50 Republicans in the Senate, no matter where you're from, you know, you support fossil fuels, you support fracking, whatever. Unfortunately, if you're one of about 8 or so Democrats,
yeah, you support fracking too.
From states where fracking takes place, I generally, and it took some time, but I came over time to pretty much like our Democratic senator in Pennsylvania, Bob Casey. But you know, Bob Casey was one of the 8 Democrats mm-hmm. to not on the tax issue, but there was a second vote on that the EPA could never ban fracking, basically, with this amendment. And 8 Democrats voted for that, including Casey and some other Northern Democrats who live in states where fracking is the source of some, you know, I mean, it drives me crazy. I mean, it's overrated as a source of jobs. I mean, yep. Yes, there are some jobs, but it's really not that many jobs for the agita it produces. And also in Pennsylvania, they're under tax. Now, I actually have come around to the position over the years that I now don't want them to tax fracking, because if they did tax fracking, they would be locked into that revenue and they would want to encourage more fracking to collect the taxes.
Right.
Then they would be hooked on the revenue. So I don't want them taxing fracking. I just want to ban it and not tax it, make it go away. There have been new studies almost every month in Pennsylvania showing either, alarming clusters of things like childhood cancer in some mm-hmm. cases, or the fact that these forever toxic chemicals like PFAS have been used in some of our fracking setups. It's disturbing. The dynamic is disturbing, you know. But I did say in the newsletter, you know, if you take away one thing from the report, it's got to be that fact that we have right. agency, that we can do something. It's a glass that's half empty, half full. I mean, we are doing more things. We have a president who acknowledges that climate change is real, which we didn't have a year ago.
True.
He's allocating, he has a plan to allocate more money to climate change, you know, to the things that we need to be doing, you know, which is electric cars, you know, solar and wind power to operate those cars and to take our power plants off, our dirty power plants offline.
Right.
Mitigation, all of these things. It was interesting. I mentioned this in a line in the newsletter, but, for better or worse, I've been traveling more this summer, like on the Pennsylvania, I've done the entire Pennsylvania Turnpike in both directions this past 2 weekends. And, you see more charging stations, you see more electric plug-in hybrid cars on the road. And you go to rural Pennsylvania, and Pennsylvania is not the most hip state when it comes to all clean energy, but we do have more wind farms and we do have more solar farms than any time in the past. And we have to we have to be in the we can do this mode. You know, I mean, we have to be real. I mean, you can't put on rose colored glasses and say, oh, we're taking care of it, because we have a lot more to do. But at the same time, we have to just stay focused on, all right, what can we do next? You know, what, you know, what we're doing a little bit better. How can we do even better next month? You know,
right. But we all need to be in on it. And too many are not. And I don't think, you know, we can't afford that kind of piecemeal compliance. We need all hands on deck, and they're not ready. So that kind of sucks. One other thing, I know we're running late, but you mentioned about, you know, the progressives, and there's still this rift between the, and they call them moderates or centrists. I call them conservadems. The conservadems like Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, and there's a whole bunch of them, and the progressives, which have been ramping up and gaining more power. Bernie Sanders is leading the whole charge on this whole infrastructure deal because it's a budget, it's a budget issue. But you did point out Cori Bush and how effective she was this week. She set out when the moratorium on evictions ended and the administration did nothing to keep it going, she said, I've been homeless. I've been evicted. This is not okay. And she camped out on the Capitol steps for 4 or 5 nights. And lo and behold, Joe Biden does something. And he admits that he may not even have the authority to do so, and there will probably be lawsuits, but maybe this will buy us enough time so that states can distribute the money that's already been allocated to help renters and landlords. That's the most infuriating thing about it, is the help has been there. It's just not getting out to the people who need it. And there's Cori Bush, freshman congressman from St. Louis, who said, I'm going to make a peaceful protest, and it worked.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, and no one's been more cynical about the Democratic Party over the last 30 years than I have. In fact, I haven't, most of those 30 years, I haven't even been a member of it, right? Uh-huh. So, you know, because it was too conservative, for a bunch of reasons, but that's one of them. You know, I mean, right now I look at the Democratic Party and I see, you know, this classic, you know, the whole team of rivals idea, you know, and I feel like the Democratic Party right now is kind of a team of rivals, and things are in kind of a good way in the fact that, because, I mean, you know, if you go back to like the Bill Clinton era, for example, I mean, that's where the term like hippie punching comes from, right?
Right.
You know,
right.
This idea of, you know, ensuring my reelection by, or the sister soldier moment, right? Uh-huh. You know, going after the far left to make myself look like a centrist and look better. And we're not seeing that today. Instead, you know, Biden, I give him credit. He's listening. You know, he listened to Cori Bush, you know, and I mean, she became a vehicle for the anger and the frustration that millions of people out there were feeling.
Yes.
And she gave them a voice, and the president listened, and that's good. And you know, I think if you look over the last year, there have been kind of a number of things, whether it's, you know, I mean, AOC was, you know, excoriated for protesting Nancy Pelosi's office, you know, over climate change. And that's what inspired the famous, you know, Green New, you know,
New Deal. That was when it was beginning, right?
The green dream or whatever, what Nancy Pelosi called
right,
it.
Right, right.
But now, you know, major parts of the actual Green New Deal are part of the agenda. Mm-hmm. And look at the influence that Elizabeth Warren has with this administration in terms of the way they listen to her ideas about things like taxation. And, you know, you know, if this reconciliation plan passes, you know, we'll be finally amping up taxes on the wealthy, and we, God knows, we could do more in that department, but at least we're moving in the right direction, you know. And in the meantime, you know, the whatever you want to call it, if you want to call them conservatives, if you want to call them moderates, whatever, they certainly also have a voice in this party.
Yes, they
do. You know? And
they have a big one.
You know, and I look at you know, the 2021 is a year that the elections that take place, except for a few special elections, they're mostly local elections, right? You know, mayor of New York City or mayor of Buffalo or races like that. And what I've seen, honestly, is if, you know, if the centrists put up a good candidate like Eric Adams in New York, And also the progressives did not put up a strong candidate.
Well, Maya Wiley, I thought, was good. I don't know why she didn't get any traction.
Yeah, I would have voted for her if I were.
Yeah, I would have too.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But you know, in Buffalo, you know, I mean, India Walton has the establishment terrified because she was a strong candidate, and she's a socialist, a democratic socialist, you know.
Yep.
And you know, in Philadelphia, our super progressive district attorney, Larry Krasner, defeated his opponent, you know. So I think there's kind of a competition going on for the heart and soul of the Democratic Party, but it's not a all or nothing competition.
Right.
It's like all the voices are competing to be heard, and people are listening, and we're getting more progressive policies like the eviction ban than we've ever gotten in any time in my lifetime, really. Or
right,
guess,
but so
I guess I was 6 years old for the Great Society. So any time since I was 6 years old, you know. So
last night the Senate, you know, did the Votorama. They passed the budget resolution to clear the way to start the reconciliation bill. And they passed out of the Senate the first part, what they're calling a $1 trillion infrastructure deal, but it's really $550 billion in new spending. You know, I don't know why everyone wants to jack up the price. It's $550 billion, but regardless, it seems like we're on the road to getting there. Although then, of course, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema had to say, well, we don't like the $3.5 trillion price tag on that. Letting you know that it's not necessarily a done deal. Do you think they're going to get this done?
I'm slightly optimistic right now. It may not be 3.5 trillion,
right?
You know, it may get scaled down. I mean, let's not forget the big criticism in the Obama administration was that he would go into these things with the cops coming out with the compromise position, right?
Already,
you know, right. Yeah. And I have to say, you know, with Bernie Sanders running the Senate Budget Committee, we're not doing that this time around. We're going into it with kind of a much bolder, not the compromise position. And I think, you know, I mean, the Biden approach is we're going to try and do things slightly the old fashioned way. So if we can do a bipartisan bill like this, not huge, but something infrastructure bill, we're going to do that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, same thing, you know, we're not going to be dictators. In other words, we're going to figure out a way to get the 50 votes. And if we have to take a few things out to make, you know, Joe Manchin or Kyrsten Sinema happy, well, we'll do that as part of the process. And there are people out there who were, you know, furious that we're not getting everything that's in the package.
Of course.
You know,
but that's how politics works. You never get everything you want.
I mean, I think, you know, I mean, to do what it would take to get everything in those packages, you would be creating other problems.
Of course. We'd lose it all. You have to be able to compromise on some front. And that's the problem with the purists who won't admit that, yes, compromise has to be part of the equation. But that's just,
I mean, we're saying is, you know, to bring the half hour conversation full circle. I mean, we're talking about saving democracy, right?
So
you want to have a process that is democratic enough that it's probably going to have to include some compromise to work, you know,
without a doubt.
Yeah. A process without any compromise is probably going to veer towards the undemocratic, and we're trying to prevent that these days. So it's a tightrope act, you know, and so far until now, Biden's still up there, you know, on the high wire. So we'll see.
Keep our fingers crossed. Will Bunch, it's always a pleasure. It's been too long. Thank you for joining us. And everybody subscribe to the newsletter. It's free and then you can read it and don't worry about a paywall. Will, great to talk to you. Thanks as always for your great work.
Thanks so much, Nicole. It's great talking to you again.
Will Bunch, there you go. Will Bunch is such a good guy, and his column is always spot on. So definitely subscribe to his newsletter. And with that, we're done. Of course, I ran over a little bit. Sorry about that. And as I tend to do these days, I will leave you with the news, because there was a lot of it over the last day or so. So take this, and I'll see you tomorrow, and Howie Klein will be here. Bye.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Well, the Senate pulled an all-nighter Tuesday night, Wednesday morning, and put the exclamation point on Infrastructure Week.
After years and years of Infrastructure Week, we're on the cusp of an infrastructure decade that I truly believe will transform America.
Tuesday afternoon, the Senate voted to advance the so-called bipartisan infrastructure package following months of negotiations. The final vote was 69 to 30. I guess that made it bipartisan, as 19 Republicans joined all the Democrats, though it's far from certain if it'll retain that designation when it goes to the House. But that's still to come. Then, early Wednesday morning, Senate Democrats approved their $3.5 trillion budget resolution. That sets the stage to write the so-called soft infrastructure package that expands Medicare, deals with climate change, child care, education, and other Democratic priorities. But before that final vote, which only needed 50 votes to pass, the Senate had to get through a 15-hour-long overnight votorama of amendments. Now, keep in mind, these amendments are non-binding, but it does provide a look at where each side stands. For example, one amendment calling for a ban on fracking saw eight so-called Democrats voting with all the Republicans. In case you're wondering, those eight were Michael Bennett and John Hickenlooper of Colorado, Bob Casey of Pennsylvania, Martin Heinrich and Ben Ray Lujan of New Mexico, Angus King of Maine, Joe Manchin of West Virginia, and John Tester of Montana. Another amendment that would prevent federal funding for fossil fuel burning power plants saw Mark Kelly and Kyrsten Sinema, along with Manchin and Tester, crossing the aisle to vote with the Republicans. Kelly, Sinema, and Manchin also voted with the Republicans to means test tax credits for electric vehicles. There were other similar head-scratch-inducing votes, like Joe Manchin being the only Democrat to join every Republican in supporting Tom Cotton's amendment prohibiting the teaching of critical race theory in K-12 schools. But shortly before 4 a.m. Wednesday morning, the budget resolution passed along party lines 50 to 49. Senator Mike Rounds of South Dakota was absent, he said, because he was accompanying his wife to cancer treatments. But he did release a statement saying that he opposed the legislation. Next, it goes to the House for approval. So the resolution needs to be approved by both chambers before the Democrats can move on to the reconciliation plan, which must still be drafted and will be considered in the fall. But the House is on recess, ostensibly until September 20th. But Majority Leader Steny Hoyer sent a letter to colleagues Tuesday saying that the chamber plans to return the week of August 23rd to consider the budget resolution. Then, only after both chambers pass it will Democrats be able to use the process known as budget reconciliation to pass the legislation on a party line vote. And then the final bill will need to clear the Senate without losing a single vote, as they have none to spare. And already, Senators Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema are both making noises about the price tag, saying that they have a problem with the $3.5 trillion number. Back to the all-night session. Once the votorama was completed and the budget resolution passed, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer then discharged the revised For the People Act. Of course, Senator Ted Cruz of Texas objected. Schumer then asked to bring up the Redistricting Reform Act, which limits partisan gerrymandering. Cruz objected to that one, too. So Schumer tried again, this time to bring up the Disclose Act, which requires additional campaign finance disclosure. And Cruz did it again. And then he tried to bring up his own legislation that would eliminate contribution limits to campaigns, to which Chuck Schumer objected. So before they left the floor, Schumer announced that the Senate would consider those compromise voting rights bills when the chamber returns from recess in September. Although this is and should be the top priority for every senator, and it does have the support of all the Democrats, as things stand now, it will not pass because of the filibuster. So I guess Chuck Schumer has a month to figure that one out. So that's a lot of news for a Tuesday in August, huh? But wait, there's more. No one really expected New York Governor Andrew Cuomo to announce his resignation Tuesday afternoon when he went before the cameras. But that's what he did.
And I think that given the circumstances, the best way I can help now is if I step aside and let government get back to governing. And therefore, that's what I'll do. Because I work for you. And doing the right thing is doing the right thing for you.
Andrew Cuomo on Tuesday announcing his resignation, this following multiple allegations of sexual harassment. Cuomo said his resignation would be effective in 2 weeks to allow for a smooth transition to Lieutenant Governor Kathy Hochul, who will become New York State's first female governor. Things are getting even weirder in Texas, where the Texas House Speaker, Dade Phelan, signed arrest warrants on Tuesday for the 52 Democrats who left the state and failed to return to Austin for a special session. The Democrats left the state last month for Washington in order to deny the Republicans of the quorum necessary to pass new voting restrictions in the state. This happened after the Texas Supreme Court overturned an order that protected the Democrats who left. What a mess. Another Texas story, 5 of the major school districts in Texas are apparently bucking Governor Abbott's ban on mask mandates. Similar situation in Florida, where Broward County on Tuesday doubled down on its decision to keep a mask mandate intact when school starts next week. This after he first threatened to cut funding for any district that dared to put in a mask mandate. And then he doubled down by threatening the salaries of school officials and district superintendents who went against his order. Amazing. Meanwhile, the situation in Florida is so bad that the federal government's Strategic National Stockpile has sent hundreds of ventilators to the state. An official with the Department of Health and Human Services told NBC News that Florida received 200 ventilators, 100 smaller breathing devices, and related supplies. As of Tuesday, there were 14,787 COVID-19 patients in hospitals in Florida. That's 145% more than during the state's last peak last July. Almost 90% of intensive care beds and 85% of all patient beds are full, and health officials are saying most people hospitalized are not vaccinated. And despite these numbers, the governor said he will not reverse his ban on mask mandates. Lovely. And now Florida is also bracing for another hit as Tropical Storm Fred has officially formed. It's crossing Puerto Rico with heavy rains and gusts, and Florida is in the cone of uncertainty. Here we go again. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is fully listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.